This Week in Retronauts. Nice game, boy. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. At the moment, this is going to be episode 341, a very significant number. Actually, I'm lying. There's no significance to that. It's just the number that this episode will be if everything goes according to plan. And I am Jeremy Parrish, for whom nothing goes according to plan. And therefore, it's a surprise to all of us. But that's okay, because this will be, I think, a good episode, nice and loose, but also informative. And it's an episode featuring someone who surprisingly has never been on the show before, despite being a supporter and sometimes contributor to the show in other capacities. So please introduce yourself, newcomer.
Is that me?
That would be
you. Oh, because Matt's been on the podcast before.
I've been on before, so this is all your show now.
My name is Bill Mudrin. I'm an artist, and yeah, I guess I have contributed to, well, more Jeremy's books than Retronauts proper, but some of his books and stuff, yeah, I've contributed illustrations and little things like that. I used to do some artwork for Electronic Gaming Monthly before that died. I contributed artwork to GamePro before that died.
Nintendo Power before that died.
Yeah, I drew the last Howard and Nestor strip and
so
Nintendo,
you're a celebrity.
Killed that. Yeah, I am a serial murderer of internet video game magazines.
Well, you know, someone's got to kill him.
Exactly. So hopefully, yeah, hopefully Retronauts will last more than 6 months after this episode.
Just don't draw for us and we should be fine.
I want to hear more about the very last, was it a very special episode of Howard and Nestor? What was the last episode?
I don't want to be that guy who's like, did you not read the last episode? You know. No, it was Phil Theobald who worked at Nintendo Power. He, I knew him just from his own podcast, Player One Podcast. And we were buddies, and he wrote me, and he was like, I have an idea. I want to do one last, like, Howard and Nestor strip for the last issue of Nintendo Power. And I drew that in, like, a weekend. And so I got to contribute to that, and I also set them up with the person who sculpted the Nintendo Power tribute to the first issue, which was the sculpted Mario thing. So.
Wow.
Oh, and you guys haven't seen this yet, because it's going up in, like, a week from this recording. But we just did a Nintendo Power episode of the show, and John Pating put together a claymation-style cover illustration for the episode. It is above and beyond what is reasonable.
Oh, that is amazing.
It's above and beyond what is reasonable for a weekly podcast like cover illustration that a lot of people won't even see. It's just insane. It's so good.
What did he sculpt? Like, what's the image?
It's kind of a reference to the first issue of Nintendo Power. It's got, you know, Mario and
we'll have to find out what
Nestor.
It is. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it'll be up by the time this is out. But yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty wild. So
that is cool.
Anyway, I don't want to get too bogged down in this stuff before we even start the episode. So who else is on the line with us all the way from Tokyo, Japan?
Who am I? I'm Matt Ault. I'm the author of...
That was very existential.
Why am I here? I'm Matt Ault. I'm the author of Pure Invention, How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World. And yes, I do live in Tokyo, where I plot my own personal world domination, but it hasn't been going very well so far.
Just waiting on that second impact. All right. Yeah, so this episode, we are talking about the life of Gunpei Yokoi, who we have mentioned many times in passing throughout the years on Retronauts. You can't really talk about Game Boy or Virtual Boy or Game & Watch or really Nintendo's history without mentioning Yokoi, but we've never really talked about him specifically, which, unless I'm just totally mistaken and somehow completely failed in searching through the back catalog to find an episode on Yokoi, which is entirely possible. Sometimes that happens. We've recorded
after 340 episodes, yeah, you're
well,
gonna,
that's the numbered episodes. That's not including the micro episodes and the shows that came before the Kickstarter. So yeah, there's like 600 episodes of Retronauts out there. And honestly, like, I do searches, you know, when I'm like, have we tackled this topic before? And sometimes a search, you know, through not only my own archives and files and our paperwork, but even on Google, like, doesn't turn up anything. And then Bob's like, well, no, actually, we did that like 7 years ago. And you probably don't remember because you were like stoned or something, except I don't get stoned. So I don't know what the excuse is. Senile, I guess.
Well, you have justification now. Hopefully your podcasting standards have increased. So even if you happen to do an episode of Gunpei Yokoi before, this one will be the new improved special edition episode of...
And he's a perennial favorite. I mean, he deserves as many podcasts as one could give to him.
He deserves better than us.
So shall we set the stage here for people who, for like the three people in your audience maybe who don't know who he is?
Yes, go for it.
Oh, am I doing this? Okay,
yeah, well, you volunteered.
You started. You called down the thunder.
Born in 194X. I actually don't know the date of his birth.
I think it's 41.
Yeah. Thank you, 1941. A day
not that
we'll
know that
infamy.
By heart, but we just happened to look at Wikipedia.
Yeah, I like
I
that
guess,
chiming or... in from both sides. I heard like 1941 coming in from both ears there.
I mean, I've got the notes open that I put together, so it's...
Well, so Yokoi was born and raised in the Kyoto area, I believe, correct? And
That would make sense. It seems like everyone at Nintendo is kind of from the olden times, was from that area.
And my understanding from reading, and he wrote an autobiography right after he left Nintendo. It's called Yokoi Gunpei Game Con, and which is like Gunpei Yokoi's Hall of Games. And it came out in, I think, 96 or 97, and he wrote it together with a writer. And that basically is where I'm getting most of my information from.
Okay.
Which is great because that hasn't been translated into English officially or in any capacity that I'm aware of. So it's one of those great video game history resources that just, it's not out there. Like, it's not available for those of us who don't read Japanese.
I've got a copy of it for a project I was working on, and I was hoping to use some kind of Babelfish or something like that to try to translate at least some of it, and I just couldn't. So I knew somebody who, there would have to be somebody like Matt who knew how to speak Japanese, or read Japanese at least.
Yeah.
He's a translator, so he's on top of things.
Yes, I am. Yeah, well, you know, it came, I had to read that book cover to cover when I was, you know, researching my own book, but it's just, it's really interesting because it's kind of half and half split between Makino-san, who's, I forget his first name, the writer who teamed up with Yokoi and probably convinced Yokoi to do the book. And so it switches from this kind of third person thing to this first person, like, oh, I was a grizzled college student when I first encountered a pinball machine, like kind of
that's
thing.
Funny.
And so it's cool. It has that kind of contextualization and Yokoi's own voice. And in his own voice, he said, when he got out of college, where he majored in engineering, he was this kind of unambitious, you know, not really driven to, I don't want to say not driven to succeed, but he just wasn't as ambitious as his fellow classmates who were all landing these plum jobs, some at local concerns like, I believe, Hayakawa Electric, which became Sharp later on, and other big, you know, companies and stuff. And he was kicking around. He couldn't find a job and he didn't want to leave Kyoto. That was like his big thing. He's like, I just want to live the rest of my life in peace and quiet.
I was about to say, that's
here.
The one thing I know is that, like, yeah, I always had the image in my head of him just kind of bumming around Kyoto. That's, I didn't realize he was actually from there, but like,
yeah,
okay, I could, that's kind of cute actually that he didn't want to leave home.
Yeah, he didn't want to leave home, and he literally says that in his book. He's like, you know, my only concern in applying to a job was I didn't want to have to like move to another city. And the funny thing was, the job he applied to at Nintendo, it wasn't even an engineering position.
Right, it was more like maintenance.
Yeah, he's like the janitor, practically. It's like he's basically like keeping these old Hanafuda machines running, you know?
I was about to say, well, that's when they were just making nothing but Hanafuda, right? Because he's the guy who introduced the whole idea of like, hey, we could make something other than Hanafuda.
No, I mean, he started at Nintendo in 1965, so he was pretty fresh out of college, 24 years old. So at that point, you know, post-World War II, Matt could probably speak to this more accurately, but...
Yeah.
But post-World War II, they, you know, Hiroshi Yamauchi was like, we got to make some money. We can't just do Hanafuda. We got to try all kinds of things. So that was kind of their period of just like throwing any shit at the wall and hoping something sticks. You know, that's
okay. So they already had the love hotels.
The love hotels, the failed instant rice, licensing like Mickey Mouse
Disney
and
characters.
Snoopy characters. Yeah, like
Disney
peanuts.
Characters. It was, and actually there's a moment where Yamauchi actually flies out to Anaheim and is given a tour of the Disney kind of facilities by Roy Disney. And that, I you know, he didn't explicitly write this, but like, to me, that is probably the moment where he's like, wow, multinational character entertainment concern. I like this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, that must have been, Yamauchi's first step towards thinking about how do we make Nintendo more of a global presence and not just like some super regional Kyoto based making old musty carts. Well, I'm assuming that must have been what led them to actually making, because I know they eventually did end up doing licensed Disney card. So I'm assuming that must have been the impetus for that. So,
Yeah, well, and the Disney cards were also key because that allowed them... I don't think you could sell Hanafuda cards in the toy store because they're meant for, like, grown-ups. And, like, by putting Disney on playing cards, like, suddenly they became almost like Pokemon cards, collectible cards. And that was Nintendo's first pivot into toys.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's... okay. That's... You're crafting a narrative here. The logical... You know, it's not just the musty facts and figures to find on Wikipedia.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
But on the whole, Nintendo's forays into, you know, all these various ventures did not do that well. The company was still really kind of struggling, I think, in a lot of ways. That's the impression I get. Like, most of Yamauchi's ideas didn't turn out so well. Like, he kind of grew into being the mastermind.
This is a totally insider conversation that I only learned about obliquely when I was interviewing people for the book. But there is, and I promise this has a connection, there's a really famous Japanese toy company called Marusan that was like the first company to license and make Godzilla figures and like Ultraman figures. They're like basically the first action figures. They made a soft vinyl. And they made a fortune off these things because in the 1966-ish time frame, there was a huge boom for kaiju. Giant monster movies and shows and stuff, right? And Nintendo was into this too. Nintendo actually made a really crappy Godzilla board game set featuring little vinyl kaiju toys.
Was it actually licensed Godzilla?
Yes, they actually licensed it. But like Marusan was the first one to realize that, you know, these monster shows would be something that appealed to kids. Now it seems like really obvious, right? Like, duh, kids are going to want to play with giant monsters. But back then it was thought that monsters and the kaiju from Ultraman were too scary for kids. And now
I was about to say mid-60s. That's right when Godzilla really started becoming. That's when you had Gamera had.
Right. Yeah.
That's when the kaiju thing really kind of started to turn towards kiddie stuff. But hadn't been known as being that yet. Yeah.
So Marusan goes boom and then it goes bust, and it's about to go out of business. And they go to their bank for a loan, and the bank is like, "We're not going to give you a loan unless you really reorganize. We have this other struggling company that we think you should talk to and you should merge with." And it turned out to be Nintendo. Nintendo shared the same bank. And so there's a moment where the president of Marusan and the president of Nintendo meet at this like hot spring resort in Atami and try to discuss whether they can merge their companies together. And the person who I interviewed, a guy named Saburo Ishizuki, who is the person who actually came up with those kaiju figures in the first place, was like, the two big personalities, it was like destined to fail. There was just no way it was going to happen. Marusan went under, Nintendo did not. And the rest is history. The end. So that's the end of that anecdote. But that's just an interesting moment and not a lot of people know about, where like this Nintendo could have turned into a kaiju toy company.
Well, it's interesting that Nintendo probably floated by on the fact that like, there, you know, there's always these whims and fads and stuff with the toy industry, whereas with cards, everyone's kind of going to need to play playing cards. Maybe they don't always have to play Nintendo cards, but, well, at least up until, God knows how many people are actually playing with playing cards now in the 21st century. But and within the scope of the 20th century, though, at least they had a reserve of cash and consumer attention that they always could kind of fall back on. So I could see, why they may have weathered the storm when actual toy companies may now not have. But
Yeah, you know, it's easy to kind of make fun of Yamauchi for trying all these crazy different things, like instant rice, you know, taxi company. But you know,
he made a lot of very shrewd choices. It's just he had to kind of find. He had to find that kind of, you know, what is the secret sauce here? What is the magic? And it turns out the answer was Gunpei Yokoi.
Mr. Gunpei Yokoi, yes. So hired in 1965, right? And so he just comes on, he's oiling Hanafuda machines, I believe. It's like he's like sweeping up around Hanafuda machines.
Yeah, he was kind of Nintendo's own Maytag repairman. Just like hanging out there after hours, waiting for the Hanafuda machines to break down, which I get the impression didn't happen that much because apparently he had a lot of downtime where he would just be like, well, time to kill some dead time. And instead of like watching TV or reading a book or something, he would make stuff, like invent things.
Yes. And he had access to a machine shop. And that was like the key thing. So Yokoi in his autobiography talks about he'd always been kind of like a tinkerer and maker of things. And when he was a little kid, he was obsessed with like model trains, and apparently built such an incredible like diorama model train layout that some train magazine actually came down from Tokyo to photograph it.
Oh, wow. I'd love to see.
And I've been trying to track that down. There must be, the story must be in a magazine somewhere. I mean, there couldn't be that many model train magazines.
Exactly.
In
like, but good luck.
Japan.
Any of that surviving to this day to be found and scanned, but like,
yeah.
Oh man, that'd be great to see though.
That's really interesting. I feel like there's maybe an episode to be put together about the influence of model trains on video games, because you know Space War was created by MIT's Model Railway Club.
Oh, like, I didn't
started,
know that.
Yeah, they started tinkering. They were just, you know, creating railway trains to scale, you know, coming up with traction and everything.
And even today, train simulations and things, you know,
they started using the you know, the huge mainframe computers at MIT to like come up with switching signals and stuff for their trains tracks and simulations and stuff. And then that kind of evolved into video games and Space War. So there's, you know, I think that was kind of like before there were really computers and video games. Like if you were kind of into tinkering and systems and things like that, you were into railway trains.
Well,
I mean, there's also Hudson. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the stuff that's what people played with. Before, like you said, before video games, there wasn't that much. And especially we need to get forward and keep on talking about Yokoi's life, but like it's also interesting to think he was only like 10 years old in like the early 1950s, where Japan was still in its reconstruction era and resources were limited, so he would have had to have been really resourceful with grabbing everything he could to, you know, build the little towns and models and toy trains and stuff like that too. So which of course that leads into we'll get into that later. That's the whole defining thing of Gunpei Yokoi. But
thought about that, but yeah, you're absolutely right. Like
I got to think about that while reading Matt's book about how, yeah, like his generation grew up like scrimping and
it just never occurred to me to apply that to his specific paradigm, but yeah, that makes so much sense.
I mean, you had to, yeah, black markets and stuff like that back then, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that first product after World War II, the tin Jeep, is made out of like hammered out beer cans and stuff.
I didn't know it was anything. Like that got that bad that like they were actually like, yeah, like I almost imagine kids playing with toys with like the beer label still stamped on or something like that.
Here comes the Schlitzmobile.
The Schlitz.
So, but,
okay.
Malt liquor. So, actually, the train thing leads directly into our next topic, which is that Yokoi, when he was, I don't know where he sourced his materials. He made it sound like he got them at a shop or something. But he, when he was a little kid, one of his inventions was he got a bunch of either plastic or wooden sticks and kind of pegged them together into this weird accordion arm device thing. And he played, you know, he just screwed around with it and played with it as a kid. And then one day at Nintendo, when he was bored because he'd already fixed the Hanafuda machines, he used the machine shop to make like this childhood invention of his in actual sturdy materials.
Right. This is like the modern day equivalent of someone who has neat ideas and then they get a job where they have unfettered access to a 3D printer and they're like, wow, the world is my little oyster.
And he makes this thing, and then President Yamauchi finds out and gets and like summons him to the office, and he thinks he's about to get fired for screwing around and using company materials on, you know, on the clock.
Yeah.
And
Yamauchi's, well, especially with as imperious as Yamauchi was supposed to have been and everything like that, yeah.
Well,
it
the interesting
a very
how
specific
did,
picture.
How did word get back to Yamauchi? Was there like a rat in the machine shop? Like, Mr. Yamauchi!
If you're Steven Spielberg and you're dramatizing this for a film, you have Yamauchi up in his office overlooking the show floor or whatever, and he can see Yokoi fiddling around, and the camera pans up and see Yokoi.
I don't think Nintendo headquarters in 1960s was, you know, the Springfield nuclear power plant.
That's
I was expecting Smithers, exactly. He's just kind of like twiddling
his Homer at the beginning of The Simpsons with a metal rod, yeah.
Smithers, bring me that man with the telescoping arms.
That's what I'm picturing, though. But like, yeah. But that's, we don't know. That's the terrible thing. We have no idea and we'll never find out.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I think you guys can take it from here, because that Yamauchi basically said, no, you're not fired. Make this into a product. And it became, drumroll please,
the Ultra Hand. Yeah. And you mentioned Kaiju earlier, and the name Ultra Hand comes from kind of the Ultraman mania. Like, everything was coming up Ultra in the mid 60s. So they were like, let's jump on that. And so they just, you know, straight up took the prefix Ultra, because it was a hip, cool, I guess not technically English, it's Greek, I guess, but whatever. It, you know, yeah, it's foreign. It's a kind of a loan word. It's cool and futuristic and fun. And this thing became a huge hit. It was their first million-selling product, apparently, that was not a Hanafuda card. I'm sure those sold, you know, a million over the course of many years, but this was like a real hit, like a fad, like a thing that kids wanted. And, you know, it was very intuitive. Like, I had not a, probably an official Nintendo one, but, you know, when I was a kid, I had, or my grandparents had one of these things, and it was just like a goofy little toy that you could use. And, you know, it's basically has little rubber grips on one end and then handles on the other, and it works just like, you know, an accordion fence or something, and you open it up and it contracts, and you close it and it expands.
It's like a Looney Tunes thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's so many horrible things that a kid can imagine themselves getting up to with one of those things. Half of those things aren't going to work out, because it's never going to be as cool in reality as you kind of dream when you see the commercial or something like that. But
yeah, and Yamauchi insisted they make it into a game. That was the big thing. And Yokoi's like, what? Like, Yokoi's literally in his autobiography is like, what do you mean make it into a game? It's just this silly accordion arm.
What, are we going to turn this into, like, Grab Ass the board game? Like, what?
That's where the balls come in.
It comes packaged
with the balls I'm referring to are little bouncy rubber balls, and they come packaged with the magic hand, and you're supposed to like use it to pick the balls up and put them in little cups.
Oh, okay.
You know, as kind of a test of skill. I don't know how many people actually did
so
that.
So it was Rob, the robot operating buddy, and Steph.
Yes!
Like 20 years before Rob was a thing.
It was.
Fess up, did either of you guys even know what this was before playing WarriorWare?
Oh, no way. Yeah, I didn't know.
Yeah, I'd heard of it.
I didn't. No way. Like, this stuff is just, there's just not much information about Nintendo's. You see all of these articles, and like, the articles I've written have been guilty about this too. Like, let's talk about Nintendo's early years. And it's like 1970, when the company's already been around for like a century.
Right. Exactly, yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, there's very little like written about Nintendo. Like, what was Nintendo like in the 1930s? Do you know what I mean? Like, there must be a story there too. But like, you know, basically history for Nintendo begins with Donkey Kong for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Or Radar Scope.
Right. But yeah, there's a blog that I highly recommend. It was where I did a lot of the research for my notes for this episode, or, you know, just having done previous research, called Before Mario. And it is literally just a blog about Nintendo creations, stretching as far back as they can find up through the advent of Donkey Kong. And it turns out there was a lot of stuff.
Ooh, that's like, cool.
Yeah, in the 70s, they created all kinds of interesting toys, and Yokoi had a huge hand in most of them, because,
yeah,
you know, basically the success of Ultra Hand was such that Yamauchi was like, okay, you're my guy now. You are heading up our research and development division. And that
was
kind
basically
of
R&D 1 before R&D 1.
Well, I mean, he was basically the head of R&D. And then as more people kind of came into the fold and sort of proved their creative mettle and, you know, came up with successes and said, made Yamauchi say, you've got the stuff and I want you to, you know, kind of have this authority. So then you had these other R&D divisions happen. You had R&D 2, yeah, R&D 3, and then eventually R&D 4, which was, you know, I think it was Genyo Takeda, Masayuki Uemura. Maybe I got those two mixed up, and then...
Well, Uemura, I thought, was two.
Yeah, Uemura is two, because he's got that seniority. Then Takeda was R&D three, and then Shigeru Miyamoto, after Donkey Kong, was R&D 4, which became EAD.
So can I talk about Uemura for a second? Because
yeah, yeah.
When I sat down, I sat down to talk to Uemura a couple years back for the book, and recently Kotaku actually published the full transcript of that conversation. But at one point he said, so Yokoi hired him from Sharp, mm-hmm, which I think was still like Hayakawa Electric at that point. It hadn't changed its name to Sharp. Yeah. And I asked Uemura what his recollections were very, very early on in his career at Nintendo, he said the thing he remembered most was they had a literal warehouse that was full, like top to bottom, Raiders of the Lost Ark style, with like imported toys and games and board games and stuff. And that was, as he
called it, distributing or just as research?
No. That was their R&D facility. Like, okay, you would go in there and take out. And, you know, and Nintendo had actually distributed a lot of Western games. Like, Nintendo, I don't know if you're aware of this, they distributed Twister to Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't imagine Japanese people playing Twister in their like tea rooms. But thanks to Nintendo,
that's a good way to figure out the market without having to invest any real skin in the game in terms of like making that stuff yourself. Is that, do you distribute kind of like how Tonka was what's supposed to distribute the?
Or Sanrio and Peanuts. Like Sanrio's distributing Peanuts is what gave them the entire idea of like, well, the dog is a hit. Maybe we should make a kitty. You know, kind of thing. So, like, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, Nintendo imported and licensed a lot of games from the West, and then sometimes when they couldn't get the license or didn't want to pay for the license, they just came up with their own variants. There was Nintendo Block, which was just Lego. It was just Lego.
Yes.
But it was called Nintendo Block, and there was, like, a, you know, very slight difference for, you know, patent reasons. As a board game example, the game Perfection, which, you know, I don't know if you remember Perfection, but it's basically, like, kind of this deep-seated board with shapes cut into it, different shapes, and the shapes correspond to plastic pieces, and you basically have a set amount of time to take this jumble of plastic pieces and put them all in the corresponding holes in the board. Yeah. Otherwise, they all pop out and explode at you when the timer comes up. They didn't license Perfection, but what they did is Yokoi designed it into a variant called Time Shock, which was interesting because instead of being a square board, it's circular and it has like two rings. Like there's just a fixed ring on the outside. And then the inner ring is this blue plastic ring and it rotates and it has 10 different places it can be. So basically there are 10 different states for this board game so that it wasn't always the same layout. So it was basically like
So it's like that 4D Vulcan chess game in Star Trek as compared to human chess.
That's what it sounds like. Yeah, that just sounds
something like that. It's basically just it's Perfection, but with a less predictable board layout. So it forces you to be more kind of on the ball when you play. So that was basically him taking that existing idea and saying, I can do it better. And, you know, it's pretty cool. So what were we talking about before Perfection?
We were talking about just all of the cool inventions he came up with in the 70s.
Yeah.
Like the Roomba. Can we talk about the Roomba?
Yes, please do. You mean Chiritori?
Chiritori. No, it's just a little battery-powered vacuum. It's a little battery-powered vacuum. I think it's remote-controlled, so there's no like AI in it or anything. But it's just another example of kind of the wacky gadgets.
Well, but it's still the same idea of like a remote. I mean, yeah, it's a robot, but yeah, instead of, you know, a Roomba that, you know, cleans by itself, you have to control. But still not entirely dissimilar to the Roomba, really. Yeah.
No, well, it's like Rob, but just much more boring. You know,
a little, slightly more useful.
The interesting thing is, do you remember the game Dust Force from like 5 or 6 years ago? There was like a 3DS game. I think it was by Capcom, but the PR sent out little, you know, press kits for it, and it had something very similar to Chiritori as part of it. And I wish I had known about this little Nintendo gadget back at the time, because I would have, you know, actually been more impressed by the fact that, hey, Capcom is kind of ripping off vintage Nintendo here, but foolish me, I hadn't read Before Mario yet, so my bad.
But I think the number one invention he came up with in the 70s that people would actually really care about is Laser Clay, the light gun game.
Well, I mean, he came up with Love Tester.
Oh, and well, of course, we all need to test, like, our love, so that is
important.
Well, I mean,
that's ubiquitous. Like, Love Tester is in every bar, every kind of divey arcade.
Did that predate, like, the Grandpa Simpson love machine? Is that, like...
That is the love machine. Like, that is the Love Tester. That's what it is. It's just like a...
Yeah, it's like you grab it. So the Love Tester sounds like a sex toy, but it's actually, like, this thing that you grab in both hands, and it tells you, like, how hot your passion is.
Yeah, we should describe what this stuff is, because, if you just talk about with the name, it just sounds nuts.
It's just detecting, like, the differential between the electrical current in your body versus
the conductivity
someone else's.
Of, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and are you supposed to, like, hold hands? You hold hands. It's an excuse. Like, Yokoi said it was an excuse to hold hands with a girl. Like,
okay,
hold hands, and then your free hand, you're holding hands in the middle, and then your free hand each grabs one terminal.
That's a great sales tactic to be like, yeah, yeah, that's
very
really
popular.
Cute.
But I mean, that is something that is, it's like a universal gadget. I'm sure it was ripped off, you know, all the things you've seen in arcades and stuff probably weren't Nintendo made, but that concept just, you know, it was everywhere.
One thing I do want to talk about before we get to the laser clay ranges, because I think that's going to lead to a lot of other stuff, is the Elekonga, which is an electric congo drum that had, like, an analog synthesizer inside.
It's basically a drum machine before there were drum machines.
Kind of like Rock Band a little bit, in that, like, you weren't supposed to smack the drum. There's just five buttons on the top that each one is preset to a different, like, sound that would play. And yeah,
it plays an analog sample.
Yeah.
Have either of you played with it?
I haven't. No.
If I saw one in real life, I'd have to steal it, because I think it may be my favorite old Nintendo thing I've ever heard about, because it's so crazy.
The wild thing about Elekonga is it's shaped like a congo drum.
Yeah, but like, really, not even like a toy conga drum.
No, it's like a real conga drum.
Yeah.
But then if you look on the side, there's a port you can open up, and it has an XLR port, and you can plug it into an actual, like, amplifier and use it to play instruments.
Wow.
And not only that, but there was an add-on device that you could buy called the Auto Player.
This is my favorite part.
There was the Auto Player, and you could program it to basically play drum sequences. So yes, this was a drum machine before, you know, Roland and everyone were making drum machines in the late 70s, early 80s.
Well, is Yokoi like the fifth member of the Beastie Boys then?
I mean, I'm shocked that no one has, like, gone on stage with one.
There's no In the Air Tonight without Gunpei Yokoi.
Oh man, if you could reprogram. Oh man, that'd be fantastic.
So that's, you would win the internet for at least a day if you could do In the Air Tonight on the Elekonga.
Yeah, my favorite part of Elekonga, though, is that attachment thing. The way it plays, like, pre-recorded music is that it's reading off of, like, an old, what's the automated piano stuff called?
A player piano?
Where it's a little paper disc with holes punched in it that reads kind of like that hole punched piece of paper.
Oh, wow.
That looks like a ViewMaster, but, like, reads it like a player piano. So you've got, like, this player piano technology feeding into this analog synthesizer drum that looks like a professional $500 conga drum. And who the hell would ever buy this? But Nintendo made it. And it's just, what?
It's like steampunk. You describe it, it sounds like a steampunk invention.
It sounds like a fever dream. Like, our coke binge.
This is the same inspiration, the font of inspiration that gave us Wii Music. This is like the opposite of Wii Music.
Oh.
Like, here's pretend instruments that you're playing in the air.
Man, they would have probably made more money if they just reissued Elekonga rather than Wii Music, but...
Probably so.
Oh, I'm gonna look for this on Yahoo Japan auctions. It's like where old toys go to die in Japan, or Mandarake or something.
Oh, man,
like that.
Get a GoFundMe going so we could buy one of those for the Retronauts podcast.
I wonder if they even work anymore, if we can find one.
I think the real problem with the Elekonga is getting enough batteries to power it, because it took, like... I think 6 C-cell batteries. Do you even remember C-cell batteries? Like, do they still make those? And then you also had to put in 2 double A's. Yeah,
they're like the size. They're like a quarter the size of a Coke can.
And that's the thing, that all this stuff. That's the other funny thing. Like, all this stuff ran on, like, 5 pounds of batteries.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, even, and I'm sure, like, barely any of the 3 Elekongas they must have sold, I'm sure most of them must be destroyed, because I'm sure those batteries all leaked 50 years ago and destroyed the energy of that stuff.
This is a big problem when you're collecting, like, old tin toys and stuff that people left their batteries in, and it just rots.
And bad, I mean, that's one of the news. Great things about these toys, because these toys were all created before laws existed that would keep them from killing kids.
But
you got
darts.
Crazy stuff like this as a result, though. But yeah.
Well, I don't think the Elekonga could really kill anybody. I mean, you'd have to, like, really bludgeon them with it.
All right. So, one more thing before we get into... Well, 2 more things before we get into laser clay. And that is the fact that the Ultra Hand was actually a line of products. There was also Ultra Scope.
Right.
And the Ultra Machine.
The Ultra Scope now was like a periscope, as I recall, correct?
Yeah, it was like a toy periscope, basically.
Not a good product in a country with notorious number of peeping toms, but let's leave that
for another
discussion.
You had to ruin Ultra Scope for everybody.
I mean, it's kind of hard to be subtle on the train with that thing. So
because that thing is like the size of a stack of dictionaries.
It is the actual size of a con tower on a submarine. It's huge.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and it telescopes. It like literally, you're supposed to like. I guess the idea in the package was you're like hiding behind a like wall, like a fence or something, and spying over it.
It's so clumsy. I mean, that also just great. That adds to the charm of the ridiculous. And all that mid-century clunk is just fantastic.
But I think, the important thing about all this stuff is that, Yokoi was this master of, like, actual physical, real-world analog playfulness. Like, he didn't start as a programmer. He didn't start as, like, a circuit dude. He's just like, mirrors and rubber bands. What can I do with this,
And it makes sense that, like, later on, he really wasn't known for being a game designer, but still just more of a tinkerer. And, like, that's why his greatest contribution to Nintendo when it, became gaming stuff was, like, the Game Boy as opposed to, like, any of the games. But
well, I imagine him as being, like, Caesar at the Colosseum, where he's just, like, people, like, are, like, racing around in front of him, and he, like, raises his thumb up or puts it down, and a product lives or dies. Do you know what I mean? Like, fun, not fun, is my impression of him there. You know what I mean? It's
like... But, he was also good at... He did have a capacity for... taking technological concepts, gadgets, and turning them into toys. Like the light telephone, I think, is a great example of that, which is basically it's like the next generation of tin cans and a string. Like instead of using a string for your tin cans, you're basically like broadcasting a beam of light that is then converted into sound. So you like talk into this thing and it transmits that somehow as light. It turns the sound into light, and then it receives on the other end and turns the light back into sound.
I can't imagine what that sounds like.
Apparently it actually sounded okay, like pretty clear.
Before recording this, I was desperate to find a video of this this working on YouTube, because sound transmitted over lights from like across the street, if you're on a sunny day or something like that, you're just gonna, whatever you end up receiving, it's gonna be like in Star Trek, when in the motion picture, when they receive the people back and they're turned inside out, I imagine it would just be the audio version of that. But
no. You say this as you are connected with fiber optics to someone in Japan.
Yes.
That's true, too. That's a good point. Yeah.
It is it was kind of the future,
but it's not. But the internet doesn't run on like a 5-cent 10-watt bulb, though, at the same time.
No, but the principle is there.
Speak for yourself, man. My internet does. The internet in my house.
I bet light telephone sounded better than Skype, honestly.
That's actually a good point.
Well, it probably sounded better than a string and two tin cans. That's certainly.
Stick together, Skype. Jesus Christ.
I think the light telephone is handy because it kind of ties into the laser clay shooting system. It's a different application for light.
Yes, he likes light.
So Matt, this is your opportunity to shine.
Laser clay. So laser clay was this, there was a, to set the stage for this, there was a huge boom for bowling in Japan in the like late 60s and early 70s, which I think paralleled a similar one in the United States, when bowling really took off and a lot of bowling alleys went up in Japan, and then suddenly, like, kind of the boom faded, and there were all of these empty bowling alleys that people didn't really know what to do with, and Yokoi came up with the idea of transforming bowling alleys. It's basically an accessory for sold to people who run bowling alleys to turn the lanes into virtual skeet shooting ranges using a light gun.
Yeah.
And, like, Nintendo gambled hard on this. Like Yamauchi went all in on this. Like they had a huge they set up all these, they sold a lot of them to, pre-sold a lot of them to various places. They had this whole campaign where Sonny Chiba of Street Fighter fame and many other movies, Kill Bill,
yeah, Not the Street Fighter you're probably thinking of, but the Quentin Tarantino caliber.
I'm talking the 1970s
Street Fighter.
Street Fighter's Last Revenge.
True Romance, slice of pie after the birthday movie kind of Street Fighter. Yeah.
Yes, yes. To three kung fu movies.
And I love... Matt, you're already my best friend.
I know, come
understand.
On, man. So Sonny Chiba is... There's an amazing photograph of Sonny Chiba with like a sawed-off shotgun like used in the ads for this that I can't find anywhere and I'm desperate for. Anyway, they pre-sell all this... And then it's based on the exact same light gun technology that later was employed for Duck Hunt, which is, it's actually, the gun isn't actually firing anything. The gun is a light detector, detecting kind of minuscule infinitesimal flashes on the screen.
I forgot that's how that works. It works backwards from what you would think it would be.
I thought the Laser Clay's shooting system, you had like a detector kind of in a set place and you were firing light beams from the gun. Is that not right?
It's like Tenet. You're capturing the bullet back in the gun, I think.
I haven't seen Tenet because it's not safe to go to theaters in this country right now.
It's in the preview.
It is interesting that like the technology they did use, just to kind of bring this back to a little bit of what we were talking about before, not that I want to go back because we need to move forward, like Tenet, but but they got the lasers, the light sensor technology came from a dude from Sharp Electronics who one day showed up at Nintendo saying, "Hey, I work for Sharp Electronics. Would you guys like to use these light sensors that we've invented at Sharp?" And Gunpei Yokoi is like, "Yes, that is awesome. Also, I like you very much." That dude's name was Masayuki Yamura, who, like, this is the first act of other people kind of coalescing around Yokoi at Nintendo, who will go on to become the core of the Nintendo we know. Yamura would go on to be the hardware designer between of the Famicom and the Nintendo Entertainment System and the Super Famicom and all that stuff. But they got their start together designing, well, originally it was the laser, the light shooting things. Yeah, the Duck Hunt and the wild original version of Route Wild Gunman. But all this turned into the Laser Clay system where, it was the big established laser shooting gun thingies. But yeah.
So it sounds like it's a really cool idea, right? Like, I want to go to a bowling alley with Sonny Chiba and a shotgun. I mean, that sounds like...
If it's 1973 and there's nothing else to do and I've already seen Sister Street Fighter 15 times, yeah, why not? Yeah.
Exactly. So, like, you're in... You know, this is... It sounds like it's a recipe for awesomeness, but what happens? Like, there's an Arab oil embargo. The first oil shock hits. This is like 1970... Or is this the second one?
It's like 72, 73.
I think this is the first one. And Japan is a country that gets like 98% of its petroleum from overseas.
Yes.
It doesn't really produce much of its own, so...
And so the oil shock was a big deal. Like, people are rioting, like, for toilet paper and stuff like that. It's like a really big deal. And like, all of the corporate customers they had lined up canceled. And Nintendo, like, it just destroyed Nintendo. It, like, plunged them, like, deep, deep, deep into the red. And
it didn't help that all the toys and products they were making were plastic, which requires petroleum.
Yes.
And therefore, they were kind of hit, you know, both on the economic side and also on the materials side.
So Sonny Chiba packed up his shotgun and went home. Yamauchi, you know, packed up, went to his love hotel. Like, Yokoi is, like, relegated to the basement. Like, Nintendo is over. Or is it? That's really the question. And then, but this is exactly the kind of event horizon. And by the way, this is the event horizon where the television game is just starting to take off in the United States.
Well, yeah, it's early 70s, yeah.
And I think this might just inflect the history of Nintendo forever. To be continued in the next 30 seconds.
This is the end of the first episode of the 10 episode long Netflix series about the history of Nintendo, pretty much. Yeah.
So no, but that's would you guys agree that's basically what happened? Like, you know, there's the light game, the light gun. This is the technology it goes bust and Nintendo is screwed. And then they kind of pivot into trying to do arcade games.
Well, this forces them to, yeah, exactly, still doing the kind of arcade stuff, but instead of having an entire fun center, you just have little installations that you could put at like department stores and things like that.
But I mean, it's not like that was the result of the video game market, because arcade installations existed already in the form of pinball, and, you know, Sega got to start by distributing jukeboxes and stuff in Japan. Namco got to start... That's right. Namco got to start by doing like little maintaining and distributing those little rides that kids can play, like the horses and stuff on springs.
Yes, they're for like department store things. Yeah.
So this was kind of, you know, like a common theme throughout the games industry. But the thing is, before Nintendo started making consoles and video games, they did go through this like revised laser clay shooting system adaptation phase, yeah, where they were basically taking the technology and condensing it to much smaller booths. Instead of saying, hey, you got to deck out your whole bowling alley with Nintendo stuff, they're just like, hey, you've got some space, you've got an arcade or whatever, here is a booth that's like the size of two jukeboxes.
So what is that, Wild Gunman?
There was Wild Gunman. There was also Fascination, the one that they didn't produce, where you shoot clothes off a woman.
Jesus, I feel like there was another laughing one. God.
But yeah, Wild Gunman was kind of their like their attempt to redeem the laser clay shooting system by basically, it's like a photo booth, basically. That's about the size of it. So okay, you have the light reflecting technology, but instead of, you know, taking up an entire space, it was much smaller and much more affordable. And that actually did pretty well for them. And I think those made it over to the US, didn't they?
Well, that was all part of the whole, like, the, what are they called? The EMs, the electromechanical games that were kind of mm-hmm. the rage right before TV games.
That's what I was about to point
out.
Like, none of this has any real, like, electronics as we know it. It's all just, like...
It's like, yeah, projectors.
Pinball parts, essentially. Yeah, projectors and multiple film reels that I don't even know how you would engineer that, because it's essentially a full motion video game, but it's using multiple film reels as opposed to even videotape or God knows a laser discs. And trying to figure out like how it switches from one film reel to another as you're shooting somebody is just, I can't imagine how they pull
that
together.
Well, good news for you, my friend. Yokoi goes into huge, huge obsessive detail about that in his book. Like,
oh, wow. Okay. So if I wanted to build my own, I could kind of crack open that book.
Exactly. You know? Roll your own. Yeah. So you can roll your own Wild Gunman. Exactly. It's
God, don't tempt me. That sounds like a great like little indie movie about a sad little geek who decides to make his own recreation of Wild Gunman because he loves Nintendo so much.
So you have the Wild Gunman toy, and then Yokoi takes that a step further and turns it into a home toy, which is where you come up with Duck Hunt, which basically took the same technology where you have the image projector and you have the light that shoots, the gun that shoots a beam of light, and basically the projector also has a sensor on it. So if you hit the duck that is projected on the wall dead center, it's going to follow the same beam of light the duck is being projected from and is going to register a hit on the sensor.
That's so,
so
crazy
it's
clever.
Basically just like taking, you know, the physics of light and turning it into a, you know, a shooting range by using reflections.
A simulation of killing things.
Yeah. And so then that was turned, you know, kind of adapted even further into something even smaller, which was the Kosinju light gun series, where you had basically a light-emitting gun, and then the sensor was actually on a small toy, and the toy was a target. So there was a custom lion, and there was a custom gunman, and these were like little figures, probably like, I think, 6 inches high or so.
Yeah.
And they had a light sensor on them.
I just realized what you're saying. Kosenju. So Kosen is light beam, and Ju is like the same Ju from Kaiju. It means beast. So it's okay. like beam beasts. I like
that's
this.
Funny.
Nice.
That's
so the
cool.
Kosen, yeah, the custom lion and the custom gunman were little figures, and they had a, you know, light detection diode or whatever in them. And if you hit that, then the toy would collapse to register the hit. It would like kind of fall into a pile.
The gunman is especially great. Yeah, if you've played WarioWare, you've done the thing where you shoot the gunman and he collapses. Well, the gunman's essentially one of those little rubber band dolls that they had back in the 80s, except now it's just tied to like an electronic device to signal the collapse whenever it's hit, but yeah.
And then kind of in between Duck Hunt and Kosinju Light Gun Custom Lion, you had Electro Safari and Electro Bird, which were a little like, they were like the size of a TV tray, a TV dinner tray. and you kind of installed them on the wall and stood back the proper distance. And basically there was a spot where a little target would appear, you know, a bird or a lion or something, and you would shoot it and it would have the lights detector in that creature. And if you hit, then it would disappear and another creature would pop up in its place. And it was basically just a test to see how accurately and how quickly you could gun down these helpless, harmless animals like the monster you are.
Yeah.
By the way, I was wrong about the Jew. It's Jew as in gun. Sorry. Not okay. Jew as in kaiju.
Farewell.
Oh, well. But it's a homonym with the kaiju, no Jew, and lots of other. There's so many homonyms.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not a mistake. I'm sure that that's deliberate. Kind of, you know, again, tying back to Ultra Hand, Ultraman. Like, those have a very similar kind of way of being written out, so...
Yes, and it was a kind of Wild West for copyright in Japan at the time, yes. Where you could get away with making things that were very, very close.
You could create Nintendo Block.
You could create Nintendo Block, or you could make your own fake kaiju, or you could make your own fake Space Invaders. Mm-hmm. Did I just say that, or think it? I think I said it.
Well, is there much of a leap between... Is it pretty much a straight thing that Nintendo decided to start just... saying, hey, well, if we're already making these home console TV games and we're already kind of doing kind of arcadey things with Wild Gunman, why don't we just make the leap to actually making, like, you know, actual electronic video game arcade units? I'm assuming that's the next step.
My impression from Uemura-san said that basically when Space Invaders hit in 78, as is his wont, Yamauchi bought a bunch of the machines and brought them in to Nintendo's headquarters for testing. And what ended up happening was the entire company ground to a halt because everybody got so obsessed with the machines. Hmm. And Uemura
I didn't even think about it. What would people just be inspired? It didn't necessarily have to be a directive from Yamauchi.
Well, he was like, play this and learn how to make games. What ended up happening was the R&D staff couldn't even get close to the machines because, like, you know, all of the every, like, you know, secretary, every, like, you know, janitor, every person on the payroll was like in line to feed quarters into this rival machine. And that was what kind of really cemented to those guys that, you know, this whole Terabee game thing, TV games, was the wave of the future, I think.
Yeah, so it's worth mentioning that the Color TV game series that Nintendo released, their Pong clones, were not made by Nintendo. They were made by Mitsubishi. And Nintendo basically just, you know, put colored shells on them and sold them with the Nintendo branding. But Nintendo did not make their own video games in the early days. And when it came to the arcade games, you know, they didn't make their own arcade games either. They were, you know, farmed out usually to Ikegame Sushinki, an electronics company that's still around, still making like medical supplies and stuff like that.
Actually, they're a broadcast equipment manufacturer, I think. They made like,
yes,
back
that
when
too.
They were... When Nintendo was working with them, they made like all of the monitors for like TV stations and things like that. And
Ikegami,
like,
monitors are still like their PVM type monitors are still very highly sought after by retro game fanatics.
In fact, we would have probably been able to play a arcade version of Donkey Kong a lot sooner if Ikegami had gone out of business a long time ago. But they wound up programming. Maybe I'm jumping the gun here, I apologize, but I just know them as the company that programmed Donkey Kong for Nintendo, and then Nintendo stabbed them in the back.
Well, they did the programming and manufacturing, or the...
They actually do the manufacturing, you know,
the
too.
The board production on, like, all of Nintendo's games from the 70s, like Sheriff, and Space Firebird, and Radar Scope, and so on and so forth. Like, those were all Ikegami. And they did the actual, like, board design, the electronics... But the design of the games was usually headed up in the early days by Yokoi. So it's bringing it back around to the topic.
Yes. And this is actually what separates Nintendo, I think, from the other game companies, which all had their own in-house R&D and programmers and stuff. And actually Nintendo's suckitude, if I might be so bold, at actually making anything itself in-house is what allowed it, and Yokoi in particular, to separate, to come up with the idea that actually you don't have to be a programmer to be a good game designer. And in fact, in many ways, you don't want the game designer to be a programmer. They're kind of totally different skill sets. And I think that's really key to Nintendo's evolution, is that especially when Yokoi started working as more of like a producer than actually making stuff.
Yeah.
And, of course, the big thing that Yokoi made that really changed Nintendo's fortunes was the Game & Watch, which we haven't, we're an hour in and still haven't even mentioned that.
I forgot that was already going on right here too. Yeah, that's, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, at this point, maybe we should save his video game era type stuff for
part two.
Another episode. Like, I don't want this one to go on too long. And I still feel like there's some interesting things to talk about from the 70s and early 80s before you get into video games. Because he also designed, like, little handheld toys and amusements. You know, Rubik's
Cube. Like 10 billion.
Yeah, Rubik's Cube was a huge, huge hit around the world. And everyone on the planet had a Rubik's Cube or three. And Nintendo was like, we got to get in on that. But of course, they couldn't just make a Rubik's Cube. So it kind of fell to Yokoi to come up with the Rubik's Cube killer. Basically their own in-house ripoff.
Or at least their answer to Rubik's Cube. Interesting
just to have
something because on the market, but
that came out after they were doing video game stuff. So it's not a pivot. Like, that was actually kind of a throwback in a lot of ways. 10 billion came out in 81, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I really kind of consider Nintendo getting into video games to be the launch of the Famicom. Because prior to the Famicom launch in July 1983, they didn't really do internal game development. I mean, basically the closest they had come to making their own game was to take the Donkey Kong board and reverse engineer that to make Donkey Kong Jr. And that was a project that Yokoi headed up. And Ikigami was kind of like, hey, guys, what's going on here?
Well, that led to a lawsuit,
yes,
as I recall.
Well, that and the fact that Nintendo contracted with Ikigami to produce X number of Donkey Kong cabinets and boards. I think just the boards, and then Nintendo made the cabinets. And then Donkey Kong turned into this huge hit. So instead of buying more boards from Ikigami, Nintendo was like, well, this is our property, so we're just going to make the boards ourselves. And so I think Ikigami ended up sourcing like a tenth of the boards that were eventually made of Donkey Kong, minuscule number, some small percentage. And they were like, well, you know, we kind of did this. Like, what's going on? We're getting cut out of our own creation here. But Nintendo was, you know, they felt like they came up with the design. It was Miyamoto and Yokoi working together.
This is actually touching on something that I think probably especially younger listeners won't realize, which is that they made their money back in the day by selling arcade boards. You were like physically selling, like, of course, that, you know, making money off the quarters and things like that was how the arcades made revenue. But how Nintendo made revenue was by selling the machines themselves. And by selling the machines, that meant selling the boards, which is exactly why, for instance, you know, when Midway pirated basically Pac-Man to make a Ms. Pac-Man, Namco took it because the Ms. Pac-Man thing was an add-on to the original Pac-Man board. You had to keep buying Namco Pac-Man boards to make Ms. Pac-Mans. But if you're like actually, you know, bootlegging something and selling a totally different circuit board, you're undercutting, you're totally basically taking money out of the maker's pocket. So, and that's what I think was going on with, that's why Ikigami Tsushinki was so upset, you know, they're actually physically manufacturing these boards, and so now suddenly Nintendo's like, actually, we don't need those anymore.
Yeah, and something like, worth understanding too is that trademark and copyright, where software is concerned, was still very much the Wild West at that point. Like, there weren't really good legal precedents to say, like, you know, what in software is copyrighted? What belongs to whom? Because Nintendo came up with, you know, with Donkey Kong, they came up with the graphics. They came up with the design of the game. They came up with the layouts of the boards. They came up with the power-up scheme and things like that.
Right.
Ikigami Tsushinki came up with the code that described that, the actual physical boards, the program. And so then the question becomes, like, whose game is this? And that was in the legal system throughout most of the 80s. And eventually the question was settled in a different case. And within like 6 months of that case being settled and resolved by the courts, Nintendo and Ikigami settled out of court, because I think it became clear at that point, like, here's who is in the wrong, here's who is in the right. And instead of, you know, going through the costly proceedings, let's just sort things out quietly off the record.
Well, and also, hadn't Nintendo poached like Ikigami's entire coding staff by that point?
Had they? I really don't know.
I thought my impression, and like, I really need to go back and read this. I think there were a lot of hires from Ikigami into Nintendo, which is how they bootstrapped themselves.
That's something I hadn't heard.
I mean, that would make sense. If you're building up your own programming department and this one company's done most of your programming, you might say, hey, come on over. We're building this thing called a Famicom computer.
Well, Nintendo had a history of doing that kind of poaching, you know, from Sharp with the Uemura and people like that. And actually, it's very forward-looking. It's very Silicon Valley. You know what I mean? There weren't NDAs or anything like that back then.
That's why you don't see real names in Japanese video game like credit scrolls.
Well, that's what I was about to say. It's funny if Nintendo's behavior caused the creation of like Yuki-chan's Papa, because Nintendo was the one poaching. It'd be funny if that's what happened.
Oh, no, everyone was doing that. I mean, you mentioned Yuki-chan's Papa from Mega Man 2, but, you know, that stuff happened with Capcom. Like, there was this constant back and forth of stealing talent. And I was just watching a video by Kid Finner's Todd Sulek, who was recently on the Lunar episode of Retronauts. He started a series on little-known developers, and, you know, he's talking about Ukiyote, the company that made games like Hook and Skyblazer, and they were basically like a guy from Capcom who designed Gargoyle's Quest and was like, yeah, I'm done here. Peace out. I'm taking a bunch of my friends with me. So like that happened all the time. And I'm sure it happened, you know, in the U.S. industry, too.
Well, in Japan, though, did you have a Lunar episode? I have to
it's not out
that
yet, but it will be by the time this goes out.
Because, you know, Hiroko, that was actually Lunar Silver Star story was Hiroko and my, like, that was our second localization job ever.
Oh, yeah. No kidding.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience working with Working Designs. But anyway, back to the original topic.
I should have had
topic.
You on that episode. That would have been...
You missed out, buddy.
Jeez.
We don't have much to say. We localized it. The end.
yeah, I think that's all.
This is a true story. We were localizing it on like paper. We were printing out the code. They just gave us like the raw code. And like it wasn't like it is now where all the dialogue is split out into an Excel file. We had to like hunt for it. And because of the we didn't really have laptops and we needed to work away from the house for various reasons. So we print out these sheets of that like old school printer paper with like the ratchet holes on the side.
The dots, yeah.
And Hiroko and I would write in the translations and then I'd go back later and enter them into the code where they needed to be. And God, that was a real pain in the ass. But anyway, salarymen. Like, it was kind of unheard of in Japan to, like, leap companies like that, I think. Nintendo was sort of ahead of the curve in convincing people to come work for it, I think.
My understanding is this whole poaching thing really did start right around the time of the Invaders boom, because everyone wanted to be in video games, and at the time in Japan, there was a very limited talent pool of people who really understood programming and coding, and so they were in very high demand. And so, you know, companies who got a hold of them were very protective and really did their best not to let their names be known, not to make people realize like, oh, we've got this gold mine right here. That's right. We've got them. So, yeah, that's just something kind of built into the industry, I think.
And not to drag this episode on any longer than it has to, but that kind of ties into what you guys were saying earlier about Nintendo also being smart enough to recognize that you don't have to be a programmer to have good game design ideas, because there was some scruffy-headed little weirdo who was designing some of the console shells for the color TV Game Watch thing. And
what was his name again?
His name was Larry something, Larry Stinkums.
Larry.
If we can get through this whole episode without mentioning his name,
I've already mentioned him.
Go back and edit it out so we could just do that one thing.
So shall we save the rest of this for Hot Shots Part 2?
Yeah, I think so. There's a few other things to talk about in the 60s or 70s. And I think the most important thing to talk about, at least I've talked about this on the show before, but it's just a thing that I love. And I think it makes a great segue into the next time we talk about their video games. and the video games that Yokoi worked on and his consoles and concepts, and that is the Lefty RX remote control car. Do you guys know about this one?
I don't know the Lefty R. I knew a guy named Lefty RX once, but...
he was a doctor, and he could only operate with his left hand.
Lefty.
So the Lefty RX was a remote control car. At the time, this was in the mid-70s, I think. And at the time, RC cars were pretty expensive, $50, $60 in 70s money. So pricey. And Nintendo really wanted to produce one that could be affordable for everyone. And so Yokoi came up with the Lefty RX. And it's called the Lefty RX because it can only turn left. It does not have the ability to turn right. It has a steering wheel or like a button that it has like forward, and I think it's the controller is forward and left. And it doesn't have the mechanisms built in to allow the wheels to actually rotate all the way to the right. And it doesn't have the electronics and the buttons to actually rotate all the way to the right. So the steering frame goes straight ahead and it goes left. And that cut the price of this device, this toy, way down. It was like half the price of other remote control cars.
Because it's only half the direction.
Right. And it still looked nice.
That's the starburst on the box.
Right. It still looks nice, but only half the directions. But the thing is, like...
simple to control.
You know, if it's a race car going around a track, it's fine. If you're just going around like a standard Indy track, you know, it's a circle. So you only need to turn left.
Or like a light cycle.
Yeah,
it's a Tron. That mechanism was pretty common in battery op robots of the time too. I don't know what it is; they would only turn in one direction. So that's interesting. I didn't realize anybody actually made a toy car that way.
And that is Lefty RX is the quintessential Yokoi creation because it is like here is a thing that lets you have something very similar to the experience that other people pay a lot of money for. And you have some compromises here, but those compromises will save you a lot of money. And
some would say broken toy, but yeah.
Almost, you know, but it's by design.
That's some pretty lateral thinking with withered technology.
It is. Oh, you had to say it. Yes. I was hoping we can get through that without that thing too, but hey, what are you going to do?
Well, you know, because there's nothing more withered than the concepts of left and right. These have been established for a while, you know?
Yeah, the whole commercial for the Lefty RX is like, you know, right is so stupid. Only stupid people go right. Cool people go left. And they put and Yokoi puts on his sunglasses and walks into a wall because it's right left to him. And I just, yeah.
Call me Lefty.
The world's most sinister racing car.
That is Nintendo in a nutshell. And I'm sure they probably sold a decent number of those toys and no one complained. It was
They did very well because they cost half of what other RC cars did. So if you were a kid on a very limited budget and your parents could not afford or would not give you a proper car, you could still have an approximation of the racing experience with this, you know, scaled down compromised race car.
Wait a second. Was there an upgrade pack for turning right? For those kids,
there was not.
Lefty RX Advance.
That's where they get you, man, on the upgrades when you want to turn the other direction. They should sell real cars like this. Think about how much more money you could make if you had to pay extra to turn right.
But that is, Greg, I know we never actually got around to talking about the Game Boy, but that really does, that just, the Game Boy was the Lefty RX of portable gaming.
Absolutely.
Everyone looked at it and said, why would you want to play on this pea soup green screen, piece of crap game thing? And Nintendo was like, no, that's the point. It's cheap and easy and cool.
They're like, hey, you can have a system and Tetris and Mario and, you know, like three other games for the cost of the Atari Lynx hardware. So why not?
Yeah.
And that screen, however, I think we need to be very clear about, that actually gave Yokoi that really messed him up. He was a mess.
That is a conversation for next time. I think this is a good stopping point, actually.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, you Game Boys.
So I lied with my intro.
Five podcast episodes about the life and times of Gunpei Yokoi.
It's like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Remember when I said I'd talk about Game Boy last?
I lied. And we just dropped Jeremy off a cliff.
Yeah. In his Lefty RX.
It's fine. This happens a lot with Retronauts. I feel like if we are having a good informative conversation, why rush it? why truncate it? Just, you know, let it expand. And there's still a lot to talk about Yokoi's video game work. So, you know, this was actually kind of a fun recap of Nintendo's prehistory that we haven't really discussed in, you know, thoroughly on Retronauts before. So it's good.
And what I like about this, if we had to run long, at least it was only because Matt had so much actually kind of new information. We weren't just regurgitating everything from David Sheff's Game Over for the upteenth time.
Oh,
so that's
guys,
nice.
I love it when you talk about regurgitation.
Oh,
Jesus. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, no, it's a hobby.
No, actually, I'm just glad to get this out because honestly, I wanted to include more of it in Pure Invention. My book out recently, but I wanted to include more of it in Pure Invention, but just because of the way things got edited, we had to deep six a lot of the research that I had done on Nintendo's early years. And just like you're saying, aside from Sheff's book, there's not, Florent Gorges?
Georges.
How do you put it? Yeah, the French guy, yeah.
Georges, his, and Isao
Yamazaki.
And yes, Isao Yamazaki? Sorry, just cracking up when you said that. And his partner. Anyway, those books have some really, really great stuff on Nintendo's early history, too. But they're not really widely available, is the problem.
No, I did manage to get the Georges books when they were briefly in print in English, and now they're like extremely expensive because they're very out of print.
I have to give credit where credit's due. I only was able to borrow my copies briefly from one Brian Ashcraft, who has like the world's largest collection of like Japanese, you know, books on Japanese topics in his house.
Is he one of those hoarders? Does he live in just like a cave made just lined with books?
A giant hollowed out Famicom. Like, you know, like the Dr. Slump characters live in a giant pot of coffee. No, I don't think so.
I was thinking more like those hoarders on the video series that Florent Gorges actually recently has been publishing and translating into English.
Oh, really?
Oh, have you not seen that? Oh, okay. I'll
no,
share the link
check
with
it
you guys.
Out.
I can't remember what it's called. But
I'd never heard of that either, yeah.
Is this Collector's Quest?
Yes, Collector's Quest. That's it.
Saison 3?
Yeah, season 3.
The first
two episodes are with this guy who, like, it's really alarming how many books he has. But this is the same guy who wrote these and translated some of these books. So it's all relative. It's all relevant. Like, he's very knowledgeable about this stuff and has done a lot of great work to bring some interesting facets of Japanese gaming culture to the West, mostly to France, but some of it does make its way to English, into English. So highly recommended. Check those out.
Will do.
All right, cool. So that's a lot of Gunpei Yokoi stuff that has nothing to do with Game Boy. So I guess we'll get there next time. We'll record again sometime soon. How's that?
Sounds great. Good. Yeah, we didn't even get to game and watch.
Nope.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, how do we screw up that badly, but in a good way?
Exactly.
All right. Well, this has been an episode of Retronauts. Thanks, everyone, for listening. You can find Retronauts on your favorite podcast catchers and on the Greenlit Podcast Network and at Retronauts.com every Monday. And you can support us by going to Patreon.com/Retronauts, which means you get the episodes that come out a week early ahead of the public with no advertisements or cross promotions, with a higher bitrate quality so they sound nice. And if you support us at $5 a month or more, you also get extra episodes every other Friday and weekly columns and little mini podcasts by Diamond Fight and maybe some other stuff. I don't know. We're always kind of mixing up the mix. We're mixing the mix. Yes, that's what we do. We mix the mix here on Retronauts. Where can we find you guys? Matt, tell us about where we can find your work on the internet and how we can support you.
You can
by buying your book.
You can find me on I'm on Twitter at @Matt_Alt. I am on Instagram at @AltMattAlt. And I'm at your favorite bookstore as Pure Invention, : How Japanese Pop Culture Conquered the World.
It's a good book. I've been reading it. Go buy it.
Thank you.
Go check it out.
Thank you. No, seriously, it honors me that people like you guys liked it. Seriously, I wrote it for people like you and people like the listeners, all of you.
I only heard about it because of the most recent episode that you were on the podcast convinced me to pick
it
up. Oh, that's
funny. Well, there you go.
That's really funny. That's great.
And Bill, where can we find you and support your work and listen to your podcast and so forth?
I am just Mudron, my last name, MUDRON, at twitter.com. My podcast is tardypodcast.com. We're known as Tardy to the Party. It's a podcast where my podcast co-host and I, we just tackle old movies and TV shows and stuff we've never watched before, and we finally get around to watching that stuff for the first time. And yeah, and I've got a shop on bigcartel.com. I think it's just a Mudrin at Big Cartel. I sell, by the time this is airing, hopefully I should have a new series of kind of Japanese print inspired Legend of Zelda prints. So if that's not up there, I must have screwed up badly. But in the meantime, I do have prints about like Studio Ghibli films and other kinds of artwork prints and things you can buy. So go check that out. But that's me.
All right, guys, thank you both for being on the show. I predicted myself. Yes, you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find me doing Retronaut stuff. You can find me doing limited run game stuff. And you can also find me on YouTube doing video stuff. I'm in the middle of like a 1 year streak of actually covering very little Nintendo content. So,
That's cool. I like that you're broadening your horizons into all kinds of weird stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes you just got to mix things up. I'm mixing the mix. It's what we do. Anyway,
we don't want to. And when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro, said a wise man.
That sounds great.
So that's all about you. It's actually Hunter S. Thompson,
oh, okay.
But it's also you.
Oh, well, there you go.
I thought that was a Jack Burton.
All right. So, this was a great half conversation. Guys, thank you again for your time. And we definitely should finish this conversation up sometime. So I'll be in touch. And in the meantime, thanks everyone for listening. And we'll be back in a week with more podcasts because we got to mix the mix. That's what we do.